All right, we're headed out to find Grant Nation. Nisha McNamara, good morning. How are you? Or good evening. Where the hell are you?
Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Where are you?
Well, I'm just in Japan right now.
Oh, well, konnichiwa.
It's nighttime, konbanwa. You're almost right. Wait 7 hours.
So, for whatever reason, an article, Grant Newsom, for those of you who don't know him, he manner needs no introduction on this program, but I'll introduce him anyway, former intelligence officer, United States Marine Corps, and retired now, and made a little bit of a cottage industry in his lifetime while in active duty, serving in the Pacific, and now he's doing it for a living. So, we'd love to have him on, and I've been, and so since Grant has been coming on the program over the course of the last 2 years, he's certainly made me smart, or at least more familiar with the issues in the Pacific Rim. So I was laying around this weekend, and I don't know what I was reading, or how the story caught my eye. But it had to do with Vietnam ceasing oil and gas exploration at a certain site because the Chinese told them to, that while it was off the coast of Vietnam, it was inside the Nine Dash Line. And this is the second project. This is a Vietnamese partnership with another private company. This is the second partnership that that the Chinese have shut down for the Vietnamese. And I looked at that and I said, wow, that you know, it started with the announcement of the Nine Dash Line, then it progresses to the fortification of seven of those reefs, three now include 10,000-foot runways, then the fortification, the missiles and all the rest of that stuff. And now the natural resources are now off limits. And these are inside everybody's economic exclusion zone, which is part of, you know, the United Nations bylaws, which China signed up for, yada, 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 yada. And so then the United States had the unmitigated gall to send a destroyer 12 nautical miles from one of these man-made, self-proclaimed Chinese pieces of territory, and the Chinese reacted. The United States is growing belligerent in the region with these kind of provocations. They then decided to fly their Air Force around over the weekend, blah, 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 blah. And now we have the North Korean train in Beijing. So, Grant, no shortage of things to talk about. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. You know, it's sometime I hope to get on your show, like when I'm awake. the nature of it.
We'll come back. Come back home. You're always out in the Pacific.
Well, that's right. I moved to Torrance or El Segundo. I'll be right in the time zone.
Well, we won't even hold you to Torrance or El Segundo. You could live in El Paso, for God's sakes. Not sure why you would want to. You could live in Arkansas, and that would at least be tolerable. But home for you is in Hawaii, yes?
I'm there more often than not, yeah. So that's right. But that's okay. You know, once I get up ahead of steam, I always, the cobwebs clear out.
Well, nobody has ever written me an email saying that, you know, that Newsom dude, he sounds like he's sleepwalking when you interview him. So, no, I've yet to receive that. Most of them are quite complimentary. So, in spite of the fog of night, you seem to do well. It's not even the fog of night. It's the fog of early morning. So, when you look at the Pacific Rim these days, the South China Sea, to me, is exceedingly interesting. There's a dynamic there of what I heard Secretary of the Navy Spencer say is China's weaponized economy. I heard the commandant of the Marine Corps say China's trying to win without firing a shot through economic extortion. You have the Philippines doing its dance of cozying up to the Chinese, but when things got bad, right, with their little insurrection they have in the southern part of the Philippine Islands, who was there with drones, who was there with special forces, people to support, and that was the United States. We don't really want to talk about that in public. Mr. Duterte doesn't want to talk about that in public so much. So the Philippines does their dance. The Vietnamese host our aircraft carriers and other warships, which is a very interesting way that they deal with the Chinese. And you see the Australians kind of dancing. And then we go to the north. Then we go to the northern end of the Pacific, and we have our pending meeting with Mr. Kim, who took his grandfather's train and his father's train full of wine and troops to Beijing. Where would you care to start today?
Okay, well, why don't I start with what you first started talking about, the South China Sea. It's about as bad as it seems. If the South China Sea was land, I think people might be able to grasp it a little more, because it's an area bigger than the Mediterranean Ocean, and China has de facto control, and the control gets stronger and stronger with these islands that they have already militarized, and they're just putting more and more equipment, hardware, and particularly surveillance systems that they, as I said, have got de facto control. Nobody quite likes to admit it, but they have. So if you were to say transpose the outline of the South China Sea and say put it into Ukraine, that would be like having a really big chunk of Ukraine rather than just a little bit of the eastern edge that Putin has got. So that is significant. And this is right on the supply, the transportation routes to and from, say, the Indian Ocean over to Japan. And the Japanese are scared to death over what's transpired. Now, so that's how it is, and ultimately the U.S. deserves the credit for allowing this to happen. It started during the Bush administration.
Hey, Grant.
But the
Grant, could I just slide a footnote in that you've taught me?
Mm-hmm.
The Japanese are terrified of this because they see this as a prelude to what will happen at some point in the East China Sea, yes?
Oh, that's just a foretaste, and that's might even be what's going to come before the next big thing in the South China Sea. But particularly in terms of energy independence, that so much of Japan's energy supplies flow through the South China Sea, in addition to just regular commercial transport. So once China does something like, say, well, where it's going to be $50,000 for every Japanese ship coming through, just for administrative costs, so we can maintain the navigation aids and our search and rescue capability that benefits everybody. That's just an example of how they could tighten the screws, and Japan's worried about that. But you mentioned, so as I say, it is pretty much the U.S.'s fault that we've allowed this to happen, you know, such is life. But now it's a question of what to do about it. And you mentioned specifically the question of Vietnam giving up an oil exploration operation just the other day. And that really is the result of Chinese intimidation. You know, the Vietnamese are tough customers, but China's big and China can intimidate them, and that's what they've done. But the real test is going to come. I think there's another oil block. I think Exxon, or an American company, has got the rights to it, and that's in a slightly different location, closer to Da Nang. And what comes of that one is going to be very interesting to watch. And particularly what I would hope is that the Americans, with the government backing, would go ahead and drill. And I'd like to have the Indians get involved too. But America quietly makes it clear that if you touch this, you've got a real problem. But if you don't do that and you allow intimidation to force the Vietnamese to give that one up, that's going to be sort of in the ballpark of setting us back as it is to invite continue to keep that invitation to China to come to the RIMPAC exercise this year. That would not be a good thing. But part of the concern here from the standpoint of Southeast Asian countries that have an interest in the South China Sea.
Okay, hold on. Is that, footnote required. Okay. Explain to everybody what RIMPAC is.
Oh, that's the Rim of the Pacific huge naval exercise that takes place in Hawaii every 2 years. And it's pretty much invites everybody in the region and even beyond who's breathing and has some ships they can send. And China has been to the last two, and that's been controversial. But they've come, and the idea is that once they see how civilized people behave, they will improve their own behavior. There's not a shred of evidence that that has worked, but the Americans continue to invite them. And China sees it as evidence that no matter what China does anywhere, that America ultimately won't do anything. And it does have that much significance to it. But going back to the South China Sea bit, the Americans, as you know, you read, they have been conducting, since the Trump administration started, these things called FONOPs, Freedom of Navigation Operations, where they sail through the South China Sea in areas that the Chinese clearly claim as their own. And this is supposed to demonstrate American fortitude. But and it's good, but from the regional nation's perspective, what really bothers them is that the American government has never really taken a clear stand on who owns what parts of the East China Sea. So, for example, they've never said, we believe Vietnam has this part, is entitled to this, Indonesia to this part, Taiwan, Philippines, etc. So by not taking a stand, it has effectively allowed China to make these claims and actually exert control and, as you saw, force the Vietnamese to give up.
Okay, so let me ask you a few questions. But internationally, there is a thing called the Economic Exclusion Zone that is a part of the way nations divide up the world in terms of resources adjacent to their nations, and also the Philippines took China to what, the International Court of the Hague over the development of those islands, and the International Court of the Hague said that China had no historical claim to those islands. And said that you don't have any claim to it, and yet none of that matters though to the Chinese, right? Because nobody backs any of that up.
That's pretty much it. That's basically it. And there's competing claims. Even if you took China out, you would still have the countries, arguing with each other over who owns what. So America, in very U.S. government, in legalese behavior, has said, well, we take no position on who owns what, and we hope people will work it out. But what China sees is, okay, well, then we'll decide who owns what, and we own it all. And so it does matter when the U.S. government stands up and says, this is what we think, and who owns what parts of it, or at least says China doesn't, and then backs it up. And that often gets overlooked in when talking about South China Sea is the failure of the U.S. government to clearly sort of articulate its belief that China doesn't own everything and that certain other countries like Vietnam are indeed entitled to such and such places. It seems like a legal point, but actually from the regional nations' perspective, it's the Americans sort of standing by with eyes primly averted while China bullies them. And it's every administration up to this one, and even this one, has failed on that score, to my way of thinking. But watch what happens with that American oil bloc and see what that should happen fairly quickly in the relatively near future. We'll see what happens. So that's the South China Sea, a little bit on that, probably more than anyone needed to know.
Well, no, let me just tell you, for those of you who follow international events like this and you're interested in watching how China does this thing, and again, General Neller's comments were during the and the Secretary of Navy, his comments about what keeps you awake at night. General Mattis says, I keep other people awake. Secretary of the Navy says China keeps me awake at night, and the way they've weaponized their economy and their whole concept of all this, the new Silk Road into Sri Lanka, into Pakistan, and with attempts to isolate and put pressure on India. And I will tell you this: it's very interesting. If you just put in a Google browser and don't close it, South China Sea, and then on a periodic basis just refresh it. And just watch the different articles and the way China, allows you access to the vast demand that can be great for a company like the Philippines that will create factories and employment, blah, 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 and then begins to choke it off because they don't like what you're doing, and then requires you to build a factory because they want the technology in China and then share. So it's this whole, it's Vito Corleone, right? Underneath the Chinese flag, and it's going on globally. The Secretary of the Navy talked about, look, they are completely redeveloping ports around the world for countries that don't have the money. All right, but there's a coupon that comes with that loan. That if you default on this, we own this. We own this piece of land. We own this port. Those are steep prices, and it's not like the Chinese won't enforce them. And so it's just so again, the Chinese thing is a big deal, and the United States has its eyes on other places, and I would just tell you it's very interesting reading to watch the way they do these things, all the while protesting, American aggression by coming within 12 nautical miles, and the way it happens, you're on a ship. And, you're just driving. You don't do anything. We used to do it to Vietnam. And I remember at that point, we didn't recognize 12 nautical miles. We recognized 2. And so we drove 3 miles off the coast of Vietnam on our way to the Indian Ocean in a freedom of navigation exercise. I mean, and it's a non-event relative to the crew and the ship. And but again, I would tell you, it's very, very interesting reading since I've become sensitized to this part of the world and these things that I didn't really know about, the 9-dash line and things like that. All right, let's some South China Sea. Let's go to Beijing. Give me the significance of him going to Beijing, which my understanding is, since he's been elected dictator of North Korea, this is his first trip to another country. What is the significance? What is he doing?
Well, I think he's just covering his back. Would be my take on it. Apparently, the Kim and the Chinese don't have a very good relationship, and certainly Kim's behavior indicates that. For example, conducting missile tests on the day. President Xi in China has very sort of important meetings and ceremonies. Just an example. But at the same time, they do share some common interests. And I think he, as I say, went there to cover his back, to make sure that he's got China happy enough when and if he goes ahead and meets Mr. Trump. The Chinese, from their perspective, they are really not very happy, apparently, by the sort of this unilateral effort by sort of the South Korean administration to bring together Kim and Trump, because it's really excluded Beijing, and it embarrasses them. And because in the past, they've always been sort of a player. And when meetings have been held, say the so-called six-party talks, to allegedly resolve the North Korean issues, they've always been held in Beijing, or China's played a major role. So they've actually been excluded from this latest initiative. But I don't think that it at all indicates that, how would you put it, that a more concessionary, that Kim is going to give up his missiles and reach a deal. I think this is just cynically manipulating, playing us for time, while it continues its nuclear weapons development. But it also demonstrates that Beijing does, in fact, have enough clout to be able to have Kim come. Whether or not he was summoned or not is open to debate. But clearly, Kim is worried enough about North Korea, about China, that he goes all the way to Beijing, his first place to go, to make sure that they're happy enough. So, as I say, I don't think it's going to, I think if we wait a few months, even if these meetings take place, I'm not optimistic about the outcome leading to a resolution from America's perspective, which is to get North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons. And certainly with the arrival of John Bolton as the National Security Advisor replacing General McMaster, there's going to be in some ways, an uncompromising person now in that National Security Advisor position on the U.S. side. And this is going to get very interesting. You don't have somebody who's willing to invariably make concessions and split the difference and kick the football that Lucy's holding out in front of Charlie Brown. It's not to say that General McMaster was a patsy, because he wasn't. He was very good. But General John Bolton has a long track record of being very clear about America's interests and his willingness not to compromise and effectively to play rough. And that's the kind of advice that Mr. Trump will be getting. So the Beijing visit is just interesting, and it just catches everyone by surprise. But I don't think it really signifies much of a change from how things are, from the current understanding of and the current sort of relationships between the parties on and involving the Korean Peninsula.
Certainly created great waves around the country. Do you place any stock? There was one issue relative to China that he executed a couple Chinese nationals for whatever reason. How sideways is North Korea with China?
They don't like each other. Koreans and Chinese basically don't like each other all that much. You know, they don't, there's these centuries of Chinese oppression and bullying and even occupying Korea. But there is culturally, there's a difference. I'm trying to think of what the comparison, maybe the French and the Germans or so. There's that fundamental dislike, even if there wasn't People's Republic of China, but just a regular China, they still wouldn't like each other very much. And the Chinese look at the Koreans as, you know, semi-savages at best. It's a difficult relationship just on that level. But in terms of the...
French, German, but if you want to take that up a notch, there's the hatred, the German-Russian hatred. So the French and the Germans, they don't like each other. The Russians and the Germans looked at the Russians as semi-human beings. They're a lower form of life. Would it be akin to that?
Oh, I think you can probably debate which the actual comparison is. Maybe it's somewhere around what you've mentioned. Right. What we've been talking about, it's somewhere in the ballpark. I think, but it's really useful, though, regardless of that. North Korea behaving as it is, and nuclear armed in particular, is from China's perspective, they don't consider it a threat, and it's really useful as a distraction, and for the headaches that it causes Japan, and particularly the United States, but also South Korea. So it really does, there's a strategic, just a very useful strategic benefit that China has from North Korea as it currently exists, as it runs, as it operates. And you look at, the distraction and how much bandwidth it burns up for the Americans to have to deal with North Korea.
Ugh.
Now, you take away North Korea, you can just focus on countering China in Southeast Asia, in the South China Sea, and even more, and as importantly, globally. So the idea that somehow China is afraid of a nuclear armed North Korea, I'm not buying it. And I think that North Korea does, it realizes that it does need China's support when 90% of North Korea's trade is with China. That it, you know, without the Chinese, if they wanted, in a matter of weeks at the most, could bring North Korea to its knees by cutting off oil, just cutting off all sort of food and other supplies to the country. So Kim's visit is really, it's one of these things that people follow it, find it very interesting because it's something out of the ordinary. But in the grand scheme of things, I don't think that it's going to be that big a deal. I don't know if it's quite accurate to say that we're headed to knuckle junction with the North Koreans. But it's going to, we're going to find out, soon enough, if Kim is serious about denuclearizing, or if he's just playing us. And I would suggest it's probably the latter. And I think that's probably what John Bolton thinks as well. I think he would go into this as skeptical as you could possibly be. And he does have a long track record. It's clear what he thinks, what his beliefs are. And this is going from really a couple of administrations of varying forms of appeasement of North Korea, where I don't think we don't have that anymore. This is going to be a bit different.
All right. When you rack and stack American priorities in the Pacific, give me the top three in order of importance.
I would say China. That's the one that threatens to move us out of the region, or else just allow us to stay at their sufferance. And that's the one that poses an existential threat to the U.S. presence, the U.S. alliance system, that really has underpinned the spectacular economic and even social and political growth in the region since World War II. You think if that does come to pass, if America is seen as having been pushed around, that has an effect worldwide. And so all these other things that you've discussed about Chinese economic expansion and sort of influence building, using money and the like, not just in Asia, but just about everywhere else in the world, even in Greenland. You know, most recently it's been announced they want to build some ports and will probably leave 50,000 Chinese construction workers behind after they're done, if it happens. So that's, you say, the knock-on effects of America getting seen as being bested and really no longer all that relevant is in Asia. That'll be felt worldwide. So I see that as the big one. North Korea is an immediate problem, just in the sense that there's a higher likelihood of actual conflict breaking out with North Korea. And I'd say that's the second one. I would actually be inclined to say the first two are China and then Korea comes third, would be my take. You certainly got, and overlooked in all of this is Chinese inroads into the South Pacific, which are little islands, but it covers a huge amount of territory and they've already done very well, getting their claws into some strategic islands like Fiji, Tonga, Vanuatu. If you get and down through that second island chain, even Palau's under pressure. And if you just get on the map, that tends to leapfrog the so-called first island chain. So they've managed to sort of jump all around and have had just immense success, and nobody's really paid much attention to that, even in the U.S. government. unfortunately. China is the main concern, and then North Korea comes after that, would be my thinking. So that's how I would look at it, is those two things, but there's just so much going on in terms of Chinese activity. And, you know, Southeast Asia, the ties have really shifted over towards China in the last few years. Cambodia is gone. Laos, similarly, in China's camp. But India is very interesting because you're starting to see the Chinese, they sort of wound up for another go at India. You know, they sort of were forced to pull back a little bit about a year ago when they were pushing up in Indian territory and also into Bhutan, which is basically India's turf. The Chinese had to pull back a little, but you knew they were just going to catch their breath, move more equipment, move more people, move more hardware right up to the border and start pushing. And that's what they're doing now. But even more ominously is the efforts by India to basically grab the water up in the Tibetan Plateau and start using that as a weapon, because every country down below depends on that. And that's what they're going to do. It's been really clear since the 50s or the 60s that someday they would do it, and they're going to do it. They're going to do it now. That hasn't gotten the attention. So you can see the Chinese the Chinese pressure. It's pretty much throughout the region. And whereas North Korea, that's to me, it's a more localized problem. Until, of course, they demonstrate that they can send intercontinental ballistic missiles to the United States and hit whatever they want to hit. What I think they have not demonstrated is the ability, they haven't mastered the reentry vehicle technology. So they can kind of shoot a missile up there quite a ways, but when it comes in, the warhead would burn up. And I think until they can demonstrate that they can routinely drop those missiles back down through the atmosphere without burning up, in other words, mastered reentry technology, I'm not that concerned. If I was Japanese, I would be really concerned already, because the missiles, the workable missiles they already have, can easily range all of Japan. So that would be my take. So it's really, for $1 million, I could come up with three, but really just two where I kind of run out of gas.
All right, Grant News from my guest here. We're talking the Pacific Rim and things related to it. Let me broaden the lens in this liberal arts discussion. How in God's name, when you deal with dictators, does anybody see a path to peace except through strength? I mean, for the love of God, Unless free nations, right, in the Pacific and in Europe and the North Atlantic, you know, come together to say, no, that's not happening. We won't stand for you dropping nerve agents in our city. And I saw a report this morning that up to, I want to say, 180 people in Great Britain have been impacted by this nerve agent that the Russians decided they would use. I mean, what in God, what the hell? And the Chinese, you know, are just a more refined version of that. Is there, you know, dare I call it appeasement and the lesson of Neville Chamberlain about standing up to dictatorships? I mean, you watch it, Grant, and it's crazy that this has gone on administration after administration after administration after administration.
I wouldn't say in fairness, but it's more in the interesting realm that this is, I suspect, been going on since, you know, Nebuchadnezzar's day. But a little more recently, it's not often remembered that after World War II in the U.S., there was a very sort of widespread belief, particularly in the chattering class in academia, that Stalin's behavior was the result of being feeling threatened by the United States. And when the there was actually a belief that when the Americans, because the Americans had a draft, you know, were drafting people into the military, that that was actually a threat. It was seen as a threat by Stalin, and that the Americans should therefore not have a draft. So this sort of thing, belief, is nothing new. But even though there's not a shred of evidence that it works, but also there's really a craven aspect to this. And it's really people think they can get money from these regimes. And China is just the classic case of it, where you've had since it opened up in the late 70s, pretty much the entire U.S. business community believing that they were going to sell one of whatever it is they made to every Chinaman and was going to be fabulously wealthy. The British thought that in the previous century. And it really is, it's this, people want money, and people will do anything for money. I've generally found that they'll behave like a sea lion when he thinks he's going to get a piece of mackerel. And you've just seen this over and over. I might refer to it as the Walmart effect. And then you get the investment banks, Wall Street, which is plays the role of, say, a hyena going after a carcass and willing to, they will do anything to squeeze some money out of both sides aiming to get into the China market. But then the academic class, the policy class, the belief was, and this was starting, as we've talked about, with Henry Kissinger, that, well, if the Chinese, if we bring them into the community, world community, extend the open hand of friendship, and even hand over advanced torpedo technology, anti-tank weapons, etc., during the Reagan era, that they will gradually liberalize, both politically and economically, and they'll become the so-called responsible stakeholder. So the mass insanity that I think we've seen over almost the last half century towards China, and only now is it sort of changing in the last 2-3 years, it's really quite something. I think if we live through it, that it's going to be something that people will study and shake their heads and wonder what people were thinking. And then after some time has passed, we'll do it again with some other dictatorial regime.
It's just the craziest. You watch it and you think, how in God's name do you as a group of free nations expect to coexist with this monolith? And now that you have a dictator for life, and you look around the world and 99% of the 95% of the turbulence on the planet is caused by four nations, all of which are dictatorships: Russia, China, North Korea, and Iran. And you know, and if you want to throw Syria in there, but Syria is more of a patsy, in my opinion. So I don't know. To me, it's just a head scratcher.
I don't want to entirely blame it all on China, because one of the wonderful anecdotes involves the United Kingdom and Mr. Putin, and particularly the City of London, which is a term that's used to refer to the financial houses, the financial companies operating in London. And there, they would, if Lucifer himself showed up with a bag of cash, they would be glad to have him as a customer. And Her Majesty's government would say, have at it, fellas. And this is what they have done with the Russian oligarchs, the kleptocrats, Putin's cronies. The City of London, with the British government's backing, has welcomed these people and their money. And the money is seen as a fundamental underpinning of sort of London as a world financial center. And the classic example of this was after Putin's guys shot down the Malaysian airliner over Ukraine. There was talk of putting sanctions on Russia. There was actually one of these luminaries from the City of London who was quoted as saying, but what will Russia do with their money? And not a peep about having shot down a civilian airliner and murdered 300 plus people. And that tells you everything you need to know about a certain class of person, a certain class of industry, how they regard dictators and really criminals of the worst sort. So it's not just towards China. If you've got a nasty regime with money, there's no shortage of Westerners who will do business with it. And it's not to say that non-Westerners aren't just as eager to do business, but they haven't quite got the same opportunities or inroads that, that we would have. So it is something that one wonders if there will ever be any sort of introspection or sort of just somebody say, man, we got that wrong. What were we thinking? I'm still waiting to hear that, but maybe someday.
The answer to that. No, I'll tell you what, it is such a head scratcher because were I the Japanese, I would be pounding the table, much like Bill Clinton did when he denied the Monica Lewinsky things. I would be pounding the table with Australia, with South Korea and Taiwan and the United States and India and whoever else was a regional partner saying, hey, if we don't get it together, my nation's next, okay? This is coming to a theater near me very soon. And we don't have a concerted response. We don't have a way to stop this short of physical confrontation. And at some point, they will fortify an island in the East China Sea, and then we will play this thing again. And then what are they going to tell our fishermen? That you can't go in here and fish? Which is what they're telling Filipino fishermen right now.
They've actually already told Japanese fishermen that implicitly. By swarming around fishing areas around the Senkakus, that Japanese fishermen have actually stopped going to areas they've fished for a long time. And you'll find that on islands like Ishigaki down to the west of Okinawa, that the fishermen there have actually begged the government to do something about it because they don't go to these places anymore. And that hasn't gotten as much attention as it should. And the Chinese can flood the zone and they've done it just to show the Japanese what's up, what's coming, in the future. They've sent some hundreds of fishing boats around the Senkakus just to say flood the zone, a year or two ago with the Chinese Coast Guard right with them and, Chinese Navy over the horizon, and the Japanese Coast Guard couldn't really respond to it. They went out and sort of tried to, but the numbers are just too great, and that's what's coming, as you say. So it's the Japanese have had a taste, and I think it's going to come. But it's one thing that's come up. I've just thought of it, and it's newsworthy. Is the economic sanctions which Trump administration is going to put on China that were announced just the other day. This is a big deal, and it's going to be very interesting to see how these play out, because it's the first time ever the Americans have actually showed some signs of applying serious economic pressure on China. And I think China is worried much more than they let on. But Trump has got by getting rid of the economic advisor Gary Cohn, a Goldman Sachs alumni, and you can probably guess what I would say about, well, I've already referred to those people, and replaced him with Peter Navarro, who has a very clear sense of China as an economic threat and a military threat. This is the first time it's ever happened. So we'll see how that goes. But as I say, I think China is more worried than they let on, because it is a system that depends on what I would call inputs. That's more sort of outside money, particularly pouring into the country to allow it to fund all its activities. And if you interrupt that, it's sort of like an engine. If you depends on having some gasoline, and once it starts running low, it can start to sputter. And so it'll be quite something to watch and see how much pressure is kept up and how China responds. But they put on a brave face, but I think they are sweating a bit.
You recently, I got an email for you here. Hold on. The question, the email brings up Douglas MacArthur. I'm curious about your thoughts of Douglas MacArthur in post-World War II. Now, the email says, hey, look, I'm not a fan of Douglas MacArthur. but even people that are critical of Douglas MacArthur said that he was the right guy for post-war Japan. I'm curious about your thoughts about him. I'm sure you've read a little bit about him, Grant. Douglas MacArthur in Japan post-World War II, your thoughts?
I think the emailer has characterized it correctly, and I, yeah, obviously I wasn't there, but from what I've read, but also I have talked to people who were here, were in Japan, both Japanese, but also Americans who were sort of in the occupation, the administration, and were close enough to have an opinion. And they, I've never heard anyone say say anything different, that MacArthur was the guy. He, I think, played it really well. He had the personality, I think, to fit in very well in that environment. And, you know, a tough guy, but also able to bend a little bit and sort of let him up easy and really give the Japanese some confidence. You know, I say just the right guy for it. And I would say if he'd done nothing else, one thing that he did is he told the Russians that if they came to grab Hokkaido and maybe even parts of northern Honshu, he said, well, then you won't do it for long. He was very clear to the Russians that there would be fighting if they tried to pull anything. And I'm not sure, and that was... Otherwise, you'd have had a divided Japan, and I think it was MacArthur's character, personality, to thank for that. So he did that very well. He did it, and he's gotten some, in some quarters, some criticism, because they did make, one of the things they kind of did make use of Japanese organized crime, Japanese rightists, and effectively the people who got Japan into World War II, to kind of run the country. After the war, and the current the Liberal Democratic Party administration that he installed or allowed to be installed basically is the direct descendants of the guys that got Japan into the war. There's some question about that, but one should ask, well, what was he supposed to do? Because it was there was a real threat of leftists and communists taking over, and that's often overlooked, so pick your poison. I think the ones he chose are better. And he transformed the society from something kind of very, really feudal almost, and into something much more consensual and where more people had sort of got more out of the system than it was. Land reform, for example, was a big deal. You know, getting rid of the secret police was another big deal. So I think he did a good job. Obviously, you can, like a lot of guys like that, you can characterize them in different ways and make a compelling case for and against him. You know, his big performance in the Korean War after Incheon, certainly was lacking. And even performance during World War II, there was a lot of criticism of him as well. But that said, you know, for post-war Japan, I can't think of anybody who'd have done better. And I can think of any number that I think would have done worse. And they could have had like Paul Bremer. And boy, who knows what would have happened to Japan. No, I couldn't resist that. But but MacArthur did a good job.
Yeah. Bremer could not wait to get out of Iraq.
I couldn't resist. So think of Bremer and then think of MacArthur. And MacArthur looks pretty good.
You have a little piece out recently about entitled How Japan Got an Amphibious Rapid Deployment Brigade. Tell everybody about it. it's almost humorous when you read it, if it wasn't such a serious topic.
It's kind of interesting, to my way of thinking at least, is that They had nothing in 2011, and when the they had no amphibious capability. When the tsunami hit, they could not get into the affected areas and conduct an amphibious rescue operation, which is what you need in those circumstances. They had nothing, and they couldn't even operate down in the Nansei Shoto, in the Ryukyu Islands. They just had no ability to do a joint amphibious operation. And given that it is an island nation, that's helpful. The Japanese army was geared to defending Hokkaido for the day the Russians invaded with tanks. And the ground sea, the ground air and the naval forces just basically couldn't cooperate. So they had nothing. And then within 2 years, they had put together an ad hoc amphibious capability and sent three Navy ships over to Camp Pendleton for the Don Blitz exercise. And for the first time, they had the Japanese army aboard with Apache helicopters and Chinooks and kind of conducted a rudimentary landing. So they went from nothing to something in a couple of years. Now, how did this happen? You've had some Japanese reformers who always knew that's what they needed to do in the Japanese army and also in the Japanese Navy. And as is the case in Japan, nobody quite wants to be the guy to take the initiative. But what happened is that you had Americans start to come around saying, you know, this is what you got to do. This is how you defend yourself. And this is the specifics of what you have, what you need to get, and how you should go about it. And the Americans were working with the Japanese, certain of the Japanese reformers. And the key to it, as I see it, is the Marines finally put a Marine in Tokyo with vague instructions to go be useful. The Marine thought that the Japanese needed an amphibious force and knew the reformers because he had lived in Japan for so long. And he went about doing it. And he educated the right press, educated some politicians, and the U.S. Navy helped out. Some of the naval officers, on the Japanese defense side, they were very helpful, of course. It was a joint effort. But the Marine officer I'm talking about was me, actually. It was I and a few other Marines that said, you know, if we ever get the chance to get somebody in Tokyo, we'll run wild and do what's necessary. And that's what we did. It was to get permission for that. To put somebody there, it was, of course, a major at Marfor Pack who sort of bulldozed the opposition, and he accomplished what three-star generals could not, got approval on both sides, and they sort of slipped me in there and went to work. And that started the chain of events, which led to, that rudimentary capability. And then once I finished, I had a replacement who was excellent. It's like the equivalent of a baseball batter who hits 900, did a very good job. And then today, actually, in Japan, they formally stood up their amphibious rapid deployment brigade. So from nothing in 2011 to this today, but it shows what you can do if you don't ask permission. But the piece, it actually got edited substantially, and it took away a few examples of boneheadedness and thoughtlessness on the American side, and I think took out some of the resentment that tends to flow in anything that I write. But one thing it did unfortunately take out was it didn't point out, and I want to mention this, particularly because where you all are in California, but it was an exercise called Iron Fist, which was started in 2006 by General Gregson, was instrumental in that. And it brought over a small group of Japanese Army to learn sort of Marine 101 and Amphibious 101. And it was it's always been a Japanese Army thing. But here's what I want to stress is that there was the guy who actually kept that flame alive was a retired Marine Lieutenant Colonel named James Whitlatch, working as a civilian for OneMEF, and he's the guy who made Iron Fist an exercise, a better and better exercise, bringing more and more Japanese Army over, and he kept it going. It's And then finally, once we got somebody in Tokyo, I was able to do the equivalent of pouring gas on the amphibious fire and get the Japanese Navy involved, and really get the sort of get something more like we would recognize as an amphibious force. So it's an interesting story, and you know, reservists tend to have a different view of how things ought to be. So it was all everyone said it was impossible, but apparently it wasn't.
I served with J. Whitlash as a we were captains in Quantico, and he came.
He came and
taught in tactics, and then. When I was at 1MEF, obviously I ran into Jay. First of all, I walked around the corner one day and walked into him. What are you doing here? Oh, I'm the 1MEF exercise coordinator. And so when we did Iron Fist, and I was the operations officer for 1MHD, which is the command element of the MEF, and with five battalions underneath it. But when Iron Fist would roll around, we would have Anglico, obviously, would be involved in it. They were one of our battalions. Ninth Comm would support it, First Intel, Radio Battalion, all those are battalions, would all play in this event. And I'll tell you what, I'd never seen it from that view before, and it was very interesting to see how keenly interested the Japanese were in doing this, in adding different elements of the training based on our experiences or different experience around the world, different technologies, you know, the San Clemente Island, not only San Clemente Island, but amphibious operations coming ashore at Pendleton. So it's very interesting to see them work as well and see what they did. So, it's Jay Whitlash. Interesting.
I just wanted to stress that because I had it in the original draft, and the editor had to chop about 500 words, and that didn't get explained the way I wanted to explain. But as I say, that's where the flame started. And he's never gotten the credit for it that he deserves, but he should. So. But that's what happened today, and it's of course it's not the end, and there's a lot of improvement that things they have to do. But this was people who really knew Japan and sensible people all said this is impossible. But if you spread enough 20s around, you can get a lot done. No, I'm joking about that. But the Japanese, you say the reformers knew what needed done, and they're the ones who did it. It does show what you can do if you don't ask permission. Because if we had, goodness, we'd still be working on the slide deck to get, commanding general approval for it. Yeah, I'm not really joking. But they certainly went pretty fast.
Grant, what will it take for, and you're more familiar with Japan, what will it take for Japan to reconstitute its military?
Because probably a North Korean missile into Tokyo, or the Japanese seizing one or more islands down in the southern Ryukyus, or sinking a Japanese Navy ship and machine gunning the survivors. I think it will take a shock like that. I don't know. I've tried to think of just how they would do it or what, but logic only takes you so far. It usually takes a crisis to get Japan to really transform. They've got a couple of near crises coming but I think it's going to take something like that. If the existing threats have not forced the Japanese to spend more money and to force the JSDF to really cooperate and learn to operate like a joint force. If the current threats haven't done it, I don't know. It's going to take something where blood is spilled, would be my take. And that's unfortunate, but I think the U.S. could probably do more to encourage and pressure even. That would be my recommendation, is to quietly call in the Japanese ambassador and tell him, look, you have got to do this. And that might work. I would rather give that a try more than just wait for the disaster to strike. Unfortunately, I think that's probably what it's going to take to do what's necessary.
Well, and you look at the void, honestly, that's created in the Pacific by the lack of a adequate Japanese military, and then you look to Europe, and you look at the same thing relative to Germany, the largest economic power on continental Europe, doesn't have a military. I mean, it does. I mean, the United States military, but it doesn't have its own organic military. And what does that do? That emboldens Vladimir Putin to do the shit that he does. And to me, even worse is the once you allow, for instance, I found it really interesting. The decision to bring China into the WTO is goes down the same road as, yeah, let's include him in, RIMPAC. Right, because the more we include them, the less belligerent they'll be. Well, the Chinese have turned that logical syllogism upside down, and it said, okay, we are going to use the World Trading Organization, the World Trade Organization, as fuel to expand our economy. With that expanded economy, we will then begin to take over through extortion. And we will compel these partnerships that will promote our stability in the world. And so we will not become more westernized, because we see America as the declining power and us as the ascending power. We will use our economic might and our huge market to reshape the world in our fashion. And then if you look at the Russian natural gas pipelines into Western Europe. When you do that, right? When you do that, and they are not a democracy, under Mr. Putin, all you're doing is you're giving him a card to play against you. And you ought not to depend on dictatorships for prosperity, for stability, because they always make you pay. And so it just seems to me, if were I the Japanese and I look at this stuff, I would find it terrifying. Look, I don't really want to spend very much of our GNP on defense. But you know what, boys and girls? We don't have a choice. Are we going to sit here helpless as a nation while the Chinese ride roughshod over the Western Pacific? No, we never have. We have always made China our bitch. All right? And sometimes we didn't do it appropriately, World War II, for example. But we have always, I would say there would be a fair amount of Japanese arrogance relative to military matters. We have always owned this area. But you can't own it without a military. And so I really, it confounds me as they look at China. We might not want to, but we don't have any choice, Grant. And so when you tell me that it would take a missile into Tokyo to make this happen, I honestly, it amazes me that they could be that entrenched in that kind of thinking, that somehow or other this will all work itself out and we'll just be a passive island nation here, and hopefully the Americans, will come to our rescue at the last minute or some nonsense like that. It's amazing to me.
Yeah, you don't want to, discount everything Japan has done, because the military does it's a sizable military, and it does have some excellent niche capabilities, particularly submarines, anti-submarine warfare, even ballistic missile defense is pretty good. But it's this pathologic dependence on the United States, which I think has created this stunted, and sort of military that's not even the sum of its parts. But right. with the U.S. help and attention, it could get much better. And that requires also both the military, but also politically to encourage and particularly pressure the Japanese to do more. But as long as there's a perception that we're going to make up the difference, well, that's what you're going to have. But in their defense, it's not much of defense, but it's, I would note that compared to some of these European countries, say the Germans, for example, the Japanese actually look really good, even compared to the British, who seem to be doing their best to get rid of their military. The Japanese look pretty good, but But that's just, you know, if you had like a guy who was starving and was down to about 75 pounds, a guy who weighed 95 pounds looks pretty good. But that's sort of an optimistic view of it all. But there's, you know, it's better than it was, but there still is, as I said, I think it's going to take a shock to really wake them up.
Well, I think historically that is the way it works, is that these things happen, and until some kind of impetus is created, and it tends to be a catastrophe, you know, motions in object tend to remain an object until they're acted upon by some greater force. And it seems to be what you see. To me, there's nothing that promotes the instability of the West like Germany and the UK's standing down their militaries. And that is, to me, you know, if you were President Putin, do you not interpret that and their weakness for just carte blanche to do what you want to do? There is no other interpretation. And I laugh when people say, oh, John Bolton's such a hawk. When you listen to John Bolton talk, all he does is he states facts. They said this, they did this. 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 And it's it's hilarious. You go down the litany of, and you're like, oh, my God. You know, I was reading about the Mayaguez grant. And so the miracle of the Mayaguez and Koteng Island fight was that more of those Marines didn't get killed on that island.
If there were any survivors.
Oh, my. It's amazing. Right. And, you know, when you say that, you know, the thing that most people remember is that, well, they left three Marines there. The heroism of Echo and Golf Company, 2nd Battalion, 9th Marines, will make your jaw drop. The heroism of the United States Navy destroyer commanders, of the USS Holt coming in 1,000 meters offshore and shooting 176 5-inch rounds, launching their dinghy with a 50 cal in it to go support, you know, just out off the surf line, and then CH-53 pilots from the United States Air Force. I want to say there was like 12 helicopters involved. At the end of the day, two were shot down. Let's see, two are shot down, seven are not flyable, and they wind up with three remaining in the last wave to help take Marines off. One of them picks up the second to the last load, is supposed to go to the Coral Sea 15 minutes away. The Holt is just off the island. It's never landed on an aircraft in its life, this 53 pilot, let alone the goddamn helipad of a destroyer. He gets the front nose down on one corner, he's balancing the back wheel, and they run everybody out the side door, and he goes back to the LZ. Takes him three attempts to get in the last time, all under heavy fire. And you read this, and you're like, holy shit. At the same time, or no, a few years before this, the North Koreans shot down an EC, I think it's called an EC-121, electronic aircraft, gathering electronic signals or monitoring shit over the Sea of Japan. North Korea shoots it down. We didn't do anything other than sail a few ships in the Sea of Japan for a few days. And you think about that, it's the greatest loss of life in a military aircraft shot down since Vietnam. And we didn't do anything. And so the playbook is they're not going to do shit. And so to me, what's really interesting about Donald Trump is, yeah, he might not be like the rest of the kids. And we're not really sure what the Americans are going to do now because he's lost his mind. He doesn't just roll out the weakness playbook. And so, I find that interesting. And Bolton, I just think he just throws the facts out there. These are the facts. These are the facts. Although I will give him low marks on Iraq. I think he certainly got that wrong, and he will eternally wear his shame and blame for that. But other than that,
we all have something. I think I like him. I think he'll be good. But as you say, he either has really strong friends or really strong enemies. But as you say, look at what he said, look at his positions, and he reminds me of Gene Kirkpatrick, the former UN ambassador, right, and even Daniel Moynihan. He'd actually be kind of a mainstream character in even what used to be sort of the conservative wing of the Democratic Party's foreign affairs. So it's at least we've got somebody who's not going to appease, and we'll see how this goes.
All right. What are you working on now in terms of your writing? What's next?
Well, after every one I write, it's like I have no more ideas left. You know, my mind is just empty. It's usually empty anyway, but I don't know. I've had like four things come together just recently, and sort of come out almost simultaneously. One about Chinese subversion in the Northern Marianas, but the one I'm thinking is have a go at the Chinese economy. And particularly addressing this, really, as I say, what I think the vulnerability to sort of an interruption in inputs and foreign investment, and the harm that could cause. And one thing I would point out is that for a few decades, every Chinese person who can is getting as much of their money out of the country and into somewhere safe, like the United States or Vancouver, or wherever, and ideally with a relative with a green card. And that's like a futures market, with the people benefiting the most from the system are not sure about its future prospects. So this challenges the narrative of this continually growing, successful Chinese economy. And also China has got exchange controls are basically limiting the amount of money that a Chinese person can take out of the country. And historically, and not just historically, like even today, a country that limits that ability of citizens to take money out has got some serious financial problems. And that's what I'm going to address. But since it's an economic topic, I actually have to try to be careful and kind of know what I'm talking about. So it's harder to construct the arguments. But we will see how that – I think that's what's next.
I find the whole Chinese Vito Corleone impersonation, I find it, incredible. And then, but to me, in the long lens of history, at some point, right, these kind of regimes, it falls apart.
I think so. I think it's more vulnerable than we would imagine, and particularly, and I think that's important to keep in mind, especially when it seems like it's on a roll and there's nothing much we can do about it. But that's what I'm going to try to sort of shed a little light on. And of course, there'll be people lining up to tell me I'm wrong, but I'll give it my best shot.
All right. Well, we wish you all the best of luck. And first of all, I have to tell you, I can't thank you enough for coming on a regular basis and making us smart about, I think a part of the world that certainly Korea has come into our lens, but the issues in the Pacific are incredibly important to the American economy. And I believe it also, it belies a future storm that's on the horizon. That is China. And the need for the United States and the free nations of the world to have a policy in terms of the way they generally deal with the Chinese. And it's because the Chinese have stolen intellectual property, most importantly, military technology and communications technology, and are now getting ready to lay it on the West. And if we, along with our allies, don't stand together, then it's going to be a very difficult period in world history for a lot of nations. And so and you've made us smart and sensitized us to all of that. And I would encourage people, I'm not joking about that, in your phone, just take a Google page and put South China Sea. And you'll get articles that pop up about the Philippines economically, Vietnam economically, Indonesia economically, what the Chinese are doing out there. You'll get all of that. And it's incredibly interesting reading. And what's at the root of all of it is Chinese dominance in the region. And they just sidestep, blame it on the Americans, sidestep, don't do this, as they enforce their self-proclaimed 9-dash line in the face of rulings from the International Court of The Hague, in face of agreements that were made that they signed with the UN, in spite of all of that. It will go this way. And if they're not brought to heel, if they're not, if the UN doesn't force China and doesn't shine a spotlight on the China not being a law-abiding, international law-abiding nation, then at some point somebody's going to get sideways and it's going to be a shooting event. And that's not going to be a good thing. So again, all that long-winded stuff to say thank you for making us smart about this part of the world. I truly appreciate it.
I always enjoy it. Hopefully it's interesting or informative a little bit. It's always fun. So I look forward to talking.
All right. Final question. Baseball season's upon us. Would you care to make a prediction? I know you're a baseball fan.
Washington Nationals.
Somebody predicted recently that the Nationals would defeat the Yankees in the World Series.
Yeah, it's like me every year predicting that. But I used to be a Senators fan, so you can see you get kind of used to being a loser.
Well, they did get rid of Dusty Baker, and that collapse last year, that was a biblical proportion. So having been a part of one of those myself, I don't envy you. So anyway, all right, Grant, thank you.
All right, Joe. Okay, out here.
All right. Grant Newsham. Okay, I want to play a little audio before we go to the break, and then you'll hear from Mike Musselman. But this is the Secretary of the Navy, the Commandant of the Marine Corps, and the Chief of Naval Operations as they were testifying in front of the House Appropriations Committee on this year's budget. So have a little listen to this.
Chairman, I want to build on the question that Chairman Rogers asked. I'd like you to give us, I'll ask two questions and then give you as much time as you want to respond. First, since we've changed our national strategy to recognize we're in a new period of great power competition, give us a quick description of the things that worry you most that the Russians and particularly the Chinese are doing now, the capabilities that they're developing, and both quantitatively and qualitatively you're worried about. And second, I would also ask you that in addition to what we're doing to counter that, how much are our allies doing to be helpful, particularly the Japanese in the Pacific and obviously the European powers in the Atlantic?
Let me provide the 30,000-foot view from the Department of the Navy, then I'll ask the Commandant and the CNO to step in. But
all right, that's obviously the Secretary of the Navy, Admiral Spencer, yes? Okay, that's who that is.
What keeps me up at night? They're two different organizations. If I look at Russia, one of the things that keep me up is their underwater capabilities. They never let up on that, as the CNO referred to earlier. I'm still flummoxed by their economic model to see where they're putting their resources, and is that in fact sustainable when you look at the demographics of their society?
Okay, what he means by that is having the size of an economy that's smaller than Canada, how is Russia doing this? And ultimately, this is their lack of investment in their population, their economy, and their economy tilted towards their small economy tilted towards a large military was what provided the basis for the overthrow and the disassembly of the Soviet Union. So with that as background, we continue.
But nonetheless, in the immediacy, it does concern me. When it comes to China, the bottom line there is the checkbook, to be very frank with you. Not only in the dollars and cents that they are writing to support their military expansion and their technological R&D work, but what they're doing around the globe that I know that you all are aware of, which is weaponizing capital, to be very frank with you. Going into Sri Lanka, redoing the port, putting an interest rate, not as aid, but as a total secured loan with a pretty hefty coupon. Debtor fails on that, and the asset owner comes and reclaims it and says these are now ours. They're doing that around the globe. And so their open checkbook keeps me up at night. I defer to both the CNO and the CMC as to their observations.
I kind of look at there's like the near term and the long term.
All right. Obviously, General Neller, you could tell by that that smooth voice he's got.
The Chinese are playing the long game. They are, as the Secretary said, everywhere I go, they're there. They don't have a list, and I'm just, you know, their concern with human rights is not there. They got big bags of cash. And if we have an issue with the host nation, I was just in Thailand, and they have not, since the coup in 14, they have not a duly democratically elected government. So by law, I cannot have Thai officers attend our schools, which they've done for years and years and years and years. I met three Thai officers that I trained as a captain. They're now generals and lead their Marine Corps. So we don't need a lost generation of Thai officers like we had a lost generation of Pakistanis and Indonesians, in my professional opinion. So they're very clever, and they're in the Marianas, they're down in the Solomons, they're doing exactly what the Secretary said. They're going in, they're buying airfields and ports to extend their reach, so that they want to win without fighting. The Russians, I think, are a little more in your face. I don't think they want to fight us personally, but I think they want to be able to impose their will and use intimidation. I mean, they're capable. They've recapitalized their capability. I'm not going to get into specifics because that's really classified, but whether it be undersea, whether it be strategic weapons, whether it be their aviation, even their ground combat. And I believe they've used the Syria operation as kind of a live fire evaluation for their systems and for their military to get them, because the one thing they don't have, like the Chinese don't have, that we have, is they don't have 17 years of war to give you the experience. Although the war we would fight with them is a little bit different than what we've been fighting. So we pay attention to it. It's something we watch, and I think that's why we're here, and I think that's why the Congress has decided that the U.S. military in order to compete against these so that we don't have to go to war. And we want to be in a position to negotiate from strength and make sure our State Department folks and the President of the United States can negotiate where we're not being held hostage by somebody's capability.
All right, we're going to take a break. Weaponized capital all over the place, buying airports, buying port facilities, getting in there, rebuilding things, right? Not as aid, as the United States would do it, to aid a nation, but it's a promissory note. If you default on the payment, we take it over. So it is a permanent partnership, because we both know that you're not going to be able to pay for it. So there you have it. Get in bed with the Chinese at the peril of your own life. Anyway, so interesting stuff. Interesting stuff from both the CNO and General Nell. All right, we'll take a break. When we come back, Mike Musselman going to join us on a Tuesday edition of All Marine Radio right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner is looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com. And I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.